You've probably heard about how important planting trees in cities is for climate change. They sequester carbon, mitigate urban heat island effects, help with stormwater management, and let's be honest, they make cities a hell of a lot sexier too. Increasing the number of trees in urban spaces is one of landscape architecture's favorite claims to making the world a better place. But how much do we actually know about what it takes to get these trees in the ground? Are we always doing good by planting more trees? And most importantly, how many of these trees are actually surviving long enough to give us the benefits that we say we are bringing to the world? Welcome to Foliage Footprints, an exclusive, limited, one-time-only podcast that sheds light on the hidden climate costs of urban trees, nursery landscape relations, and what we can do about any of this as designers. We are David McKenna, Garrett McGill, and Angzai, and we're here to rock your roots.
You're not just looking at an object like a light post or a, you know, a hydro mast. It's not a pole. It's a living system.
I think we just need to do less and provide nature more time and space.
Air, soil, and water.
Today we are talking trees, specifically successful trees. Jim Arbin, who we spoke with, has a helpful definition for what a functional tree is. It provides functional environment benefits. They must be large enough to shade homes, pavement, cars, and people. The tree should live long enough with minimum maintenance so that its benefits are not outweighed by the cost of maintenance and replacement.
It's interesting because that sounds like a bare minimum. Landscape architects seem to advertise tree planting as achieving so much more than this.
They do indeed, and what I love about this definition is that it focuses less on selling the idea of trees and more on the accountability of designers to make more informed decisions. It also connects to how we started this podcast journey.
Ong is referring to a report that inspired our initial direction. Researchers in Sweden studied three species of trees. A cradle-to-gate analysis investigated the carbon adult trees must sequester in order to compensate for emissions produced from nursery production, transportation, and final establishment on site. We initially thought nursery production was going to be the bad guy here. Oh boy, were we wrong! The carbon footprint of these trees averaged 10 kilograms of CO2 during nursery production, 35 kilograms during transportation, and a whopping 100 kilograms during the final establishment phase. Results showed that on average, it took 16 years after planting for the trees to compensate for initial carbon emissions. In other words, net absorption of CO2 emissions begins 16 years after planting.
But now, in the past, I've had projects where we need a certain variety of tree or hedge.
That's the voice of Jack Tupper, a landscape architect who works for the city of Vancouver that specializes in planting design. He's worked in the UK, Switzerland, and in both the public and private sector here in Vancouver. We interviewed him while our focus was firmly on this relationship between landscape architects and nurseries, and he gave us some interesting insight into how landscape architects can specify smaller tree sizes in order to reduce the financial and carbon cost of plant establishment.
If you use a large tree and put it on site, it takes a long time for those roots to establish, and essentially it pauses its growth for like 5 years until its roots are established. If you put in a younger tree that's perhaps 3 to 5 years younger, the roots establish much quicker, and what you find is by that 5-year mark, the trees are essentially a similar size anyway. And it keeps your costs lower. I presume it keeps the carbon cost lower as well.
Jack's suspicion is correct. This lined up with our research, which showed that the establishment carbon costs of planting trees could be reduced by planting younger trees, reducing the need for heavy equipment. Our interview with Jack revealed that these kind of strategies depend on having an ongoing relationship with nurseries. But it was a discussion about Vancouver's plan to increase the urban canopy of the city by planting 100,000 trees that caught our attention more than anything else.
While the project was a success, there was a dieback of some of the trees that were planted just because of the summer heat. What we found, or what we're finding now, is Vancouver for the longest time had a steady stream of rain through the year, so trees could survive even in the smallest amount of soils because they were watered as needed. Now that our summers are getting drier, those trees aren't able to survive in the same conditions, and it's highlighting the streets that weren't properly installed.
This topic of improper tree installation felt like a rabbit hole worth exploring. Each tree that failed to survive beyond its first few years, let alone meet the 16-year threshold, is not only a humiliation in terms of carbon footprint, but also fails to deliver any targets of a functional tree.
You can't just go in and plant 100,000 trees in 1 year and expect it to be a success. What we're seeing, and you can walk down any street in Vancouver, there's a significant portion of the street trees dead and removed, and now there's just tree grates in the ground with nothing in them.
There was a new urgency to our investigation, a call for some kind of solution to planting trees that would never live long enough to shade our streets. Thankfully, Jack left us with a clue pointing to where we might start looking.
Trees go in, they look healthy for 5-10 years, but then there's not enough space for them. So that's one of the significant areas that needs to change.
The problem seemed to be below ground. James Patterson, a soil scientist for the National Park Service, speculates that 90% of urban tree issues are a result of improper soil conditions.
Engineering the environment to meet the basic principles of a tree's survival and longevity.
That's Adam Nicklin, a principal at Public Work, a Toronto landscape architecture and urban design office. He's describing how his priorities for placing trees in urban spaces has changed over the years.
The thing I think I would add now, which is top of mind, is not only not leaping straight to the city as a hard surfaced, hard paved environment, and how can we think more about designing the urban environment to replicate some of the natural systems that we see are central to the success of a tree and in the ecological system it exists in.
We contacted Adam after finding a document he worked on for the City of Toronto. The document looks at planting and utility strategies for maximizing the growth and the health of street trees.
And the goal, I think, put together a manual, like a technical manual for achieving, you know, increased urban tree canopy and better trees in hard spaces. These performative and actually quite explicit details ready to go so that anyone could do it. And I still stand by the work as being good in that way.
The document was a result of Adam and his colleague, James, opening with a reference to a 1995 study showing the average age of an urban tree in a downtown American city was only 7 years.
It presents 4 guiding principles to increase the health of urban street trees as follows. Provide 30 cubic meters of soil per tree. Create larger pavement openings of at least 1.5 meters across. Integrate existing and future utilities into the root system corridor and strategically design systems with fewer components.
The document attaches the approximate costs of each of these installations so policymakers, planners, developers, and landscape architects can all have a clear understanding of what it takes to plant a successful tree.
The document also stated questionable stock from nurseries as a contributor to tree failure. Even with our focus shifting to investigate the successful establishment of tree in urban spaces, it appeared that nursery practices still did have a role to play. But Adam wasn't convinced that blame should lie solely on the nursery.
We would argue that a lot of the practices in nurseries are based on the commercial procurement model for planting trees in products, in projects, which are a product of the way that landscape architects work. So this notion of, I want 5 trees, I want them to be perfect. If one dies, you replace it. So each tree is measured on its own merit and lives and dies on its own form and performance.
This comment harkened back to some of the frustrations Jack faced in Vancouver.
The city says this road has to have an avenue of street trees in the sidewalk boulevard. It's on the developers to put those in, but nobody checks if the developer is actually installing the groundwork correctly.
Jack goes on to say that this is mainly due to an inability to keep up with Vancouver's rapid development. But he's also faced roadblocks when trying to get the proper below-ground infrastructure installed.
We typically don't use soil cells in engineering right-of-way because the engineers don't trust it. They don't know whether they can get access to it, whether it works for utilities. So they're saying, like, We can only use solar cells when we've got the data that supports them. But if they won't let us put them in, we're not going to get the data.
Adam's team faced similar utility concerns in Toronto. They ended up implementing test mock-ups to prove the viability of silva cells in complex right-of-ways. The mock-ups tested an emergency burst water main scenario as well as a gas line installation, and results were good. The water main repair was done without problems using existing repair methods, and the gas line installation was actually considered easier due to the looser soil present in silva cells. Adam's team has used this mock-up method on several projects, and he considers it a crucial element of designing outside the status quo.
The project itself can become a mock-up or a pilot for the next thing that you do.
Overall, Adam considers this project a success in many respects, but he sees viewing trees as sole units of performance as something that has to shift in the industry.
What would be missing in that approach? So for instance, you know, if you see a tree in a natural environment, you're not just looking at an object like a light post or a, you know, a hydro mast. It's not a pole, it's a living system. To encapsulate that system in concrete, yet still provide some of the theoretical requirements of the system, but in isolation, only solves part of the problem. And it goes a long way, and you should do it.
Between political campaigns for tree planting, pressures from developers, and engineers hesitant to prioritize tree health, the problem felt bigger than landscape architecture. Adam's work showed us that landscape architects do have a role to play in improving the conditions of urban trees. It seemed we were looking at a failure in the foundation of our profession. Landscape architects were supposed to help mitigate the effects of climate change, yet who knew how much carbon was being dumped into the atmosphere to grow, transport, and establish trees whose survival wasn't even guaranteed. We wanted more direction, and discovered James Urban, sparking hope for new solutions.
When I started, nobody was thinking about soil at all.
Jim is a Lorax, a landscape architect who's dedicated his career to improving the lives of urban trees. He was involved in advancements in manufactured soil, as well as the invention of the silva cell. And his book, Up by Roots, is an extensive guide to planting trees that contains specifications and design guidelines for landscape architects.
Jim discovered the urban tree crisis in the 1980s when he attended a conference where a microbiologist named Tom Perry challenged everything landscape architects were doing, and Jim was convinced that this was a critical issue. But like us, he was feeling overwhelmed about how we could actually change things.
The last thing I said to him was, Tom, okay, you convinced me. Now, what do you want me to do? And a brilliant thing that he could say was, you know, not my profession. That's your job.
Jim did just that. He spoke at length with me about how his journey led him into the dirt. As we'd found in our conversations with Jack and Adam, the root of the problem of failed tree establishment was in the roots, or rather, the soil that surrounded them. And Jim had certainly tried it all.
The rabbit hole of CU structural soil, which I helped invent and champion for a good 5 or 6 years, and eventually now say you just should not use structural soil.
What amazed us most about this journey was its return to simplicity. Jim highlighted that the key to everything was adapting to new information. While he spent years of his life exploring new technologies, he had no problem admitting that the true solutions to poor soil were much less complicated than some would have you believe.
If I was writing a spec now, I would say, soil should be brown. You know, what color brown? But go down the street and buy a Hershey's milk chocolate bar and look at it. If it's darker than that, it's perfectly fine.
Jim's book emphasizes the importance of soil in the success of urban trees, detailing specifications, guidelines, and strategies. Start with the soil. Give each tree 30 cubic meters of soil and a minimum 2.5 meter tree pit opening. Draw details that fit tree roots in 30 to 40 years. In the face of budget constraints, plant fewer, smaller trees in the best soil conditions.
But although there were countless resources available to landscape architects, many produced by Jim himself, it's been hard for him to see so many projects planting trees incorrectly.
We're talking almost 50 years at this point, and I look at landscape architecture and landscapes that have been recently built, and there are days when I just go home and cry because nothing on that project changed.
It feels like it's impossible not to run back into the problem of external decision makers. How can landscape architects push for this less flashy approach when projects have established tree targets? Shouldn't this change start at the policy level? But Jim, like Tom Perry, says that landscape architects hold the primary responsibility to change our industry's practices.
And I've run across all of those comments and ideas by landscape architects, and I think that on the face of it, it's bullshit. You know, I'm gonna design this retaining wall. And it's gonna be made out of concrete, but you know, the goddamn reinforcing bars add a lot of cost to that wall. But we're just gonna take it out. What would happen to a landscape architect if they said that in a meeting? They would be laughed out of the room, or people would be astounded, or whatever. But no landscape architect would ever say that, because they know if you take the reinforcing out of a concrete retaining wall, it fails. Why is soil different than the reinforcing in concrete?
James describes how planting specifications in contracts are the key to holding the entire industry to a higher standard. He says, we are professionals who are signing off on contract documents, and any trees we approve for design must be specified correctly, including the below ground conditions.
This conversation about specifications led us once again back to nurseries. Jim acknowledged that nursery practices could result in two potentially fatal conditions for a tree. Stem girdling roots were due to starting its life in a pot a tree had roots that may strangle it, and improper branching structures. But like Adam, Jim placed the responsibility of solving these problems on landscape architects. Specifications that consider these conditions unacceptable already exist. Landscape architects just aren't enforcing them.
And sometimes you get, well, nobody ever asked us that question before. I said, well, it's your professional society.
These kinds of standards are the reason that the CSLA and ASLA exist, and by pushing for stricter soil standards, the act of planting a tree improperly can be treated similar to pavers with defects.
You wouldn't think twice of rejecting a dozen paver stones because they have cannonballs in them. Well, if we go to that level of detail in our work, why wouldn't we go to the same level of detail for the trees we're putting in?
While current specifications exist, Jim says a key problem is something called the guarantee of life. This is essentially an insurance policy that says as long as a tree lives 5 years, then the landscape architect nor the contractor aren't responsible for its death.
The problem is that none of the problems that we're talking about in the nursery industry show up in 5 years or even 10 years.
The more we talked, the more we realized that landscape architects must lead the change we were looking for in the industry.
At that point, I was using soil trenches. The developer said, yeah, this is really nice, Jim, but we're taking them out. I said, okay, that's up to you. So, but if you pick the soil trenches out, I'm quitting. And the developer said, okay. Any of the landscape architects out there, here's the door. Within the same year, I was in another meeting with another architect and another developer, and we had the same situation. The developer said, we're not going to pay for these soil trenches. And I said, well, you don't want to do it. I'm out of here. And the architect looked at me and said, do you really mean that? I said, absolutely. He said, well, then let's sit down and talk about it. We sat down and we got soil trenches on that project.
Landscape architects have a responsibility to educate themselves on treating the trees they claim to love so much as seriously as every other element of design. We can use existing standards and specifications and the fact that we are registered professionals who sign off on drawings to justify these actions. Once we can all get behind this, we may even begin to see a change that leads us to a new kind of urban planting. Something Jack, Adam, and Jim all hinted was the next step forward for urban trees and forests.
But the only thing I can guarantee is if your design looks like something you've seen in Landscape Architecture magazine, probably wrong.
I think we just need to do less and provide nature more time and space.
How do we start to replicate abstract natural environments within streets, and how do our terms need to change to accommodate what we're really after, I think, which is ecology in the city?
So be bold, all ye burgeoning landscape architects. Never forget that deep down, we should all have a little Lorax in us.